particularly from the baby's point of view. And as a neurologist, I see a screen hanging over a bassinet, and I'm thinking, you are blocking the central vision that is developing in a human being. Get that thing out of the way. Mm-hmm. A human face, is the most fascinating thing to a baby. Mm-hmm. And when the adult and the child lock their eyes on, their EEGs, their brainwaves synchronize. You know, so there's this is all happening during a critical period, what we call the critical window. And if you don't get socialization early on, it will never happen. Mm-hmm. And this, incidentally, is one of my worries with all this virtual learning in school now, is that young kids, you know, kindergarten, preschool, grades 1 through 3, they need to learn emotional and social learning. Mm-hmm. And if you don't get that via screen, you need to be interacting with other kids, with the teacher. You need to get into arguments, learn how to resolve your disputes, learn how to play together, take turns, all the kinds of things that, you know, we think are so normal. Mm-hmm. You actually have to learn how to do these things.
This time on the Plutopia podcast, Richard Cytowic joins Maggie Duvall in the virtual studio. Dr. Cytowic is a neurologist and author noted for his study of synesthesia. In this episode, he discusses virtual autism or digital distraction.
Welcome to the latest episode of the Plutopia podcast. Our guest today is Richard Cytowic, who is going to talk about, among other things, synesthesia. You can find Plutopia at plutopia.io, and all of our stuff is posted there. You may be listening to this as a podcast. You may be watching it on YouTube. You can find us on Twitter. We're at Plutopia on Twitter. And there is a Plutopia News Network Facebook page. And we do Radio Free Plutopia once a week. And you can find information about that on Facebook as well. Today, the conversation is going to be led by Plutopia's own Maggie Duvall. Maggie, take it away.
Take it away. Okay. Well, Richard, it's great to have you here. I've been an admirer of yours since the early 90s when a gent I was dating in San Francisco, who happened to be a lighting designer, I was hanging out with him. He was setting up a show at the Fillmore. I happened to talk about the way I perceive music and color, and he just turned to me and pointed right in my face, and he said, "I bet you have synesthesia." And I'm like, "What the hell is that?"
Yeah,
doesn't everybody like perceive the world this way? And then he said he had just read your book, The Man Who Tasted Shapes. So I read it and devoured it, and I've been following your work for quite some time.
That's in the small world department. The Man Who Tasted Shapes was, in fact, Michael Watson, the late Michael Watson. And he was a lighting designer who taught at the North Carolina School of the Arts.
Seriously?
But he also was a Tony Award winner for Pat is Dead. So when he mentioned offhand that he said, "Well, I taste things by shape, and when I taste something, I feel it on my face and in my hands, and a feeling sweeps down my arm, and I feel weight, shape, texture, as if I'm actually grasping something." And I was just trying to be polite, because he said, "Well, as a neurologist, maybe you'll understand." And I said, "Oh, well, you have synesthesia." And he said, "You mean there's a name for what I do?" So he didn't know back then. And that was in 1979. So
exactly.
I'm glad by 1990 it had filtered into the mainstream.
Yes. And what was interesting too, just one more little preface, several years back, I sent my daughter, who's neurotypical, to an experimental school where she was learning alongside kids on the autism spectrum. So mm-hmm. This is kind of like a segue into the virtual autism. But it was so that these kids would have a chance in a safe place to practice social cues and that kind of thing. And I remember one day we brought some angel food cake. And the son of the director, who was on the spectrum, said, this tastes blue. And I pointed right in his face and said, "I bet you have synesthesia." And he goes, "Of course I do." So that led to an interesting conversation with the director about where we were wondering if perhaps synesthesia, you know, you brought it out of obscurity, but I posited maybe it's an evolutionary leap, right? You know, being able to see it all or experience it all at one point in time. So just with that preface, I would like to talk a little bit about synesthesia, but it's been covered so much. Mm-hmm. I kind of want to aim the conversation more because people can follow up on your excellent website.
Wherever you want to go, sure.
But I wanted to talk a little bit about what you're calling virtual autism. You said that and I've read some of those articles, you have a very popular column on Psychology Today, but they got rid of it?
They took it down, yes.
What happened?
I had to revise it, and currently the editor's now looking at it for the third time. They seem to be really squeamish about the idea that screens induce any kind of autistic behavior. And so I first heard of the term virtual autism. It was coined by a doctor in Romania, and then also research came out of France, and then gradually in the United States. We just had two very marvelous papers in the JAMA Pediatrics about screen exposure, heavy screen exposure early in life, inducing autistic-like behavior. And I want to be very, very careful because we hear the word autism and people get all hysterical. It doesn't induce autism. That is a developmental, largely genetic condition. All right. Whereas virtual autism is the appearance of autistic-like traits early in life. And these traits are, again, a high detail-oriented focus, so they're glued to the screen, just as you'll find autistic kids glued to a picture book or an object or a clock or something like that. Mm-hmm. They don't respond when you call their name. And then most babies, by 9, 12 months, they'll respond to when you call their first name. So they have the sort of blank look to them. So I've gotten, before Psychology Today took that column down, it was one of my most popular, and I got email from Iran, from Switzerland, from Brazil, from all over the world, from parents and grandparents who were terribly alarmed, and they would send me pictures, mm-hmm. which I include in my forthcoming book on digital distractions. Mm-hmm. Showing, you know, here's Parker looking like a zombie, and here he is 8 months later after we took away all the TVs and the screens and the iPads, and you see this happy, cheery, smiling, engaging little fellow.
Wow.
And so we're just getting to do, I mean, obviously one needs to have really, really highly controlled studies to prove that this is so, but the anecdotes are so overwhelming that you certainly think there's got to be something there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you can't wait. I mean, these are critical periods during a child's development. You can't wait 5 to 7 years for a double-blind prospective study to be done in order to take action. And the action is really simple. It's don't drug, unplug. So take the screens away. And
I was noticing, I took a walk around the lake in Austin several years back, and I was shocked to see a couple jogging with their baby stroller. They had their earplugs in, you know, it's a beautiful day, earplugs in, and their little child was in the stroller with an iPad. With the air, you know, like, so there's nature all around, but there was a singular focus. And it was
like that marvelous scene in the movie WALL-E, where all the people on the spaceship, they're all fat and rolling around in these automated lounge chairs, all with the screen in front of them, you know, not ignoring everything around them.
Absolutely. And
there is even the iPotty, which is a toilet training device that has the iPad in it.
What?
There is the bassinet thing, and of course then the car seats, and you know what, think of it from the baby's point of view, and as a neurologist I see a screen hanging over a bassinet and I'm thinking, you are blocking the central vision that is developing in a human being. get that thing out of the way. Mm-hmm. A human face is the most fascinating thing to a baby. Mm-hmm. And when the adult and the child lock their eyes on, their EEGs, their brainwaves synchronize. You know, so this is all happening during a critical period, what we call the critical window. And if you don't get socialization early on, it will never happen. Mm-hmm. And this, incidentally, is one of my worries with all this virtual learning in school now, is that young kids, you know, kindergarten, preschool, grades 1 through 3, they need to learn emotional and social learning. Mm-hmm. And if you don't get that via a screen, you need to be interacting with other kids, with the teacher. You need to get into arguments, learn how to resolve your disputes, learn how to play together, take turns, all the kinds of things that, you know, we think are so normal. Mm-hmm. You actually have to learn how to do these things.
Yeah, precisely. And of course, it's magnified this year with the COVID. I know that a number of kids I know about are in despair because they can't connect. They are yearning for that.
I hear the same thing. Yeah, my neighbor's kids all say the same thing.
Yeah, and I was reading your article, The Digital Distraction, Energy Drain, and Your Brain on Screens, right? And mm-hmm. and it's packed full of so many different points, so many quotes that I wanted to cover.
You're referring to the American Interest article?
This is in Psychology Today.
It's okay.
20th. Yeah. Yes. So the statement, the 21st century mindset is now one trapped in the immediate present, in need of constant external stimulation. You said that we're technically more connected to one another than ever before. And then we bond on media platforms engineered to make outrage and indignation infectious. Mm. That kind of freaked me out. They exploit the psychological principle that emotion like yawning is highly contagious. Would you elaborate on that? This, I loved you. You said the digital deluge, there's no nuance or complexity, this overstimulation, everything that's happened this year with the election, so on. I'd love you to elaborate.
Yeah, any point in particular or all of it?
All of it. Especially the propaganda, that line there you say in here, Russia didn't hack Facebook to sway U.S. elections. It simply used the platform to its advantage.
Right. Yes. It's like when, you know, you wag your finger at tax evaders and say, or tax loopholes and say, well, this is the law. They just took advantage of the conditions in the law in order to pay the minimum amount of taxes, for example. So yes, Russia didn't do anything. It simply used the software that anybody is free to use. And when I say that emotion is infectious, so, you know, you watch a comic, let's say, on Zoom with no audience, and do you howl with laughter? No. But you have a studio audience watching, you know, Jay Leno, Johnny Carson, or whatever, and they're just cracking up every single person doubled over because the laughter is infectious. Right. Yawning is infectious. Mm-hmm. We've all experienced this. And then, of course, negative emotions. I mean, Hitler, and look at Leni Riefenstahl's films, The Will to Power. I mean, my God, he got stadia full of people all riled up very, very easily. And then, of course, the whole population of Germany. And we see this with today's politics. You know, tune into either, you know, Fox or MSNBC, and you'll see people on either side ranting at the other side. And that nobody stopping to actually listen to what the other side is saying or trying to understand why it is that they think the way that they do. Everybody's wants to change the way you think. Let's say you and I disagree. So we're gonna shout at each other, hoping that we're gonna change the other's point of view, and that's not gonna happen. Mm-hmm. And so the social media sort of amplifies that a great deal. And it's meant to, you know, stick encourage outrage and indignation. So you see something on Facebook, and so, yeah, it's so easy just to click, I like, or to retweet it, either just as is or to add your own angry comment to it. The guy at Facebook who invented the like button is full of remorse. He is so regrets that he ever invented that thing. And of course, the whole point from Facebook's point of view is to engage the user and get them to click on whatever they're clicking on with the hopes that they'll see an advertisement and click on that. And then Facebook makes more money because you've done that. So the more they're able to stir the pot, and it doesn't take much, the more money they make. Reminds me of an old Twilight Zone episode called The Monsters Are Out on Maple Street.
Yes.
And these suspicious neighbors, you know, and they're all, and at the end of it, they're all ready to murder one another. And the camera pulls way back. And we see two aliens sitting in a spaceship. And one turns to the other and says, "See, all you need to do is sow a little suspicion. There's no need for an invasion. They'll do it to themselves."
Yeah, yeah. And I'm curious. I've seen a lot of people starting to talk about, I'm feeling controlled, manipulated. You know, people are seeing the documentaries, they're reading the books, you know, some are reading the books. And it's like, you know, we're all kind of ranting about this, but we're not doing anything about it. What do we do? What do we do? Do you have any ideas? Do you have any answers?
Quit.
Yeah.
For one thing, go take a walk. Spend some time with yourself. I think we're so surrounded by this, you know, the babble, that it really helps to go out and put yourself in some green space. It doesn't take much. One tree will do. If you have a little park or something, fine, go there. Nature is very restorative. And so whether you have a beach or a city park or something out of the mountains, a mountain trail, a hiking trail. These are enormously restorative to the human brain and the human psyche, the soul and the psyche. And then, you know, I do what Gandhi, you know, Mahatma Gandhi, there's a story where he killed his neighbor, which left the neighbor's son an orphan. And Gandhi said, "You must take him in and raise him." Mm-hmm. And of course, he was Hindu. And he says, "But you must raise him as a Muslim." So, you know, "I don't want to do that. Oh, no, no, no." Yeah, you have to. You have to see the other point of view. And I think that's the other thing, is to realize that, well, and this, let's go back to synesthesia, because this is what synesthesia does. And I'm so happy when, you know, sixth graders have this eureka light bulb go off and they say, "Oh, other people see things differently the way that I do." And so, yes, every person, every brain has its unique, singular point of view, and they're all going to be different. And so it really helps to get a little zen about this and try to appreciate the fact that other people have their own points of view, and they're not necessarily wrong. They're simply different.
Yeah.
I mean, take medicine. I mean, I'm a neurologist. Chinese neurologists, we're looking at the same thing, but they practice in a totally different way Eastern medicine does than Western medicine does. And yet it's the same human body. There's no difference, but they're looking at it. Their perspective is different. So I think for everybody who's so incensed, so if you're a blue person, and I hate this red and blue business, but if you're a liberal, you know, watch Fox News or whatever those shows are, Tucker Carlson, etc., and try to understand why those people think the way that they do, and what are they saying that you're not? And then for the Fox crew, do the same. You know, why is Rachel Maddow so popular, you know? And it may, you know, sit on your hands or strap yourself in if you need to, but give yourself a dose of the other side.
And also,
it's like taking a spoonful of bitter medicine. It's good for you.
Yeah, well, but maybe it's part of that, you know, where we expect constant stimulation of some kind. You had mentioned in your intake, the idea of people learning to be with themselves again, or maybe yes. for the first time. Why do you think it's so difficult? I mean, for me, I've always loved my own company. I have a great time with myself anyway, but so many people, especially during this pandemic, are just, I can't be with
people. They can't be with themselves. Yeah.
Yeah.
This isn't something new. It's existed a long time. And I've talked about this for a long time too, is that, there are people who are very comfortable, you know, sitting quietly, reading a book, or just thinking, you know. They don't have to be a human doing. They're just a human being. Mm-hmm. And then to contrast that, you'll go into households where the television is always on, quote, for background noise. Well, I don't want to have all that noise. I like quiet, you know. When I go to the beach, I love the sound of the ocean. I don't want to hear a radio with the latest, you know, top 40 hits on it. That's not why I came to the beach.
Yeah.
So there, that's existed as far back as I can remember. But now you've got, you know, Baroness Greenfield, Susan Greenfield, in her book Mind Change 2015, talked about that we are, we've become an immediate sensation society, as opposed to seeking understanding, where we always want constant sensation. Mm-hmm. And the iPhone, I mean, when we got our iPhones late, we were in New York once, you know, a city set up on a grid, and we couldn't find something, a restaurant or whatever. And with exasperation, we said, we've got to get an iPhone, if only for the maps. You know, we had track phones for calling out in emergencies, yeah. and that was it. So when I finally got it, it was like, oh my God, no, I wonder these things are so addictive. You know, the endless scroll is like the slot machine. One more, one more, one more, one more. Mm-hmm. Right, left, you know. And so and they're designed that way. Intermittent positive reinforcement is the best way to get mm-hmm. you to perpetuate a habit.
Yeah, and I hadn't noticed, it's just been in recent years that I started noticing, I would get really overstimulated with going into a restaurant. And it's like, I would like to have a nice quiet meal with who I'm with, but they're banked everywhere and it's nonstop. And like, when did that start happening, right? And then—
yeah, it's so noisy that you can't even talk to the person you're with at the table. And I often ask the waiter, I said, can you ask the manager to turn the music down?
Yeah. And I was a little shocked coming, I moved from New Mexico to Texas in the mid 2000s. And there's a lot of empty space in New Mexico. Here in Texas, I went and camped with some friends, and in the campgrounds, you're supposed to be in nature.
Yeah.
Everyone brought TVs. I was like, what? Wait. Anyway, but you know, I think about that just constant need to have the background, to have that kind of companionship. You know, in that same article I was mentioning earlier, you talked about how the kids are, you know, continuing to check their phones. You know, they'll go to sleep and they'll wake up and check, and then and how it's messing with circadian rhythms. You've been talking a lot about the circadian rhythms lately. If you could elaborate.
Right, because we've just had the change back to standard time.
Yeah.
And there's fascinating research actually by Arkos Gosch in Switzerland showing that people actually play with their phones while they're supposedly asleep. So that's how it's become your mini brain, you know?
Oh man, it's in your hand.
So they're still tapping the, swiping the screen while they're asleep.
Wait.
I know, I'll give you a moment to let that sink in.
Oh, that's creepy.
You know, and so many people say, oh, I'm so addicted to my phone, I'm addicted to my phone. But then you try to take it away from them, and you've all seen these pictures of two-year-olds. You try to take the iPad away from them, and they scream and they yell. My blankie, you're taking it away.
Yeah, and there's the overwhelming panic when you can't find your phone, you know? It's
Nomophobia. It's a word coined for that. The fear of not having your mobile phone, and those experiments too. People were invited. They took their phones away, and they're invited to sit still until the examiner came back. Or they were allowed to press a button, which would give them an electric shock. And the majority of people, I mean, 90% of them, couldn't sit still with their own thoughts, even when they were encouraged to, you know, fantasize about an erotic liaison or a marvelous tropical vacation. They would rather shock themselves to occupy their attention than to just sit there with their own thoughts.
Yes.
You know, and the funny thing is, you know, people who decide they want to learn to meditate, they want to learn, you know, they want to know what my mind is like. Well, the first thing that happens when you sit still with your eyes open and try neither to think nor not to think, this is the Soto branch of Zen, you notice that the mind is a raging torrent of thoughts and opinions and judgments and justifications and rationalizations and anxieties. And that's the normal state of your mind. And what Zen tries to do is say, okay, imagine you're sitting under a bridge and there's cars going overhead. Mm. And the first one says, oh, there goes a BMW, there goes a Nissan, there goes a Cooper Mini, etc. That is deliberate thought. You're chasing something. Mm-hmm. Okay. Whereas just sitting is you let them go overhead without giving them much notice. You don't comment or notice them. You stay seated, just focused on your breath and your physical presence there, keeping still. And it's very hard to do. You know, people said they learned, you know, count from 1 to 10 and then do it over again. Well, most people can't even get to 1, let alone 2 after many, many months of trying to do this. I've done this for 30 years now. So, you know, the natural tendency of the mind is to go off to the races. And this is why quiet, silence, being in nature is, it's a tonic. We don't need Prozac and pills and cocaine. We need to just be with ourselves and the world. Mm-hmm. The world is so, I mean, as a scientist, I mean, science is incredible because we learn how things actually work, how things actually are. And the world, the universe is absolutely fascinating. I haven't become bored with it yet. And right. I'm nearly 70 and I'm gonna keep fascinated by learning new things.
Yes. Yeah. It's another thing I recall when my daughter was growing up, how she was never bored because she knew how to, I raised her early out in the sticks, right? So her toys were rocks and sticks and sure. dirt and all that. And she would play, she'd do make-believe. And so many kids don't know how to do that anymore.
Oh, how to play with a box, a cardboard right? box, yeah. make up your own games. You play restaurant or shoe store with right? your sister or mailman yeah. or whatever. You don't need anything. So a box could become a fire engine or an airplane, you know.
Exactly.
We used to do that all the time when we were raking leaves in the fall and putting right? them in boxes from the grocery store. And we'd hop in the boxes and we'd play, I don't know, whatever we play.
Exactly. I mean, it's hours of fun and you just change it around and, you know, and that imagination is yeah. so wonderful.
So being alone, being mm-hmm. in an urban setting is conducive to this. Germany and France have a green class, the Germans call it Kittefahrt, which are outings. And they take kids as young as 3 years old with their teachers out in the countryside to be in camp for a couple of days. No parents, no cell phones. The teachers just say, if we need to reach you, we will. You know, okay. no, yep. there's no texting, no checking up, nothing.
Yeah.
And young kids learn how to play with sticks and stones and mud by the river and roast sausages around the campfire. The older ones help the younger ones. You learn how to ask for help. You learn how to give help, etc. In Germany too, young kids are sent to the bakery on errands, and it's totally normal. And everybody sees this, and the baker is, you know, engages them and other people, you know, meine Junge, et cetera, because by law, schools in Germany must raise students to be self-sufficient citizens.
Wow. What a concept.
So yeah, if you're 5 years old, go to the bakery.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Thrive and function.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and so if you do that at five, you're out on the street and, you know, all the people and stuff, and you learn to be brave very, mm-hmm. very fast. You lose fear. And I think the notion of having to have some constant stimulation speaks to the fear of being alone, because when you're alone with your thought, a lot of people just go crazy. They do not like it. It feels awful.
Yes.
And what a strange thing.
Yeah.
You feel awful about yourself. I mean, just think about that. What is it about being with yourself that is so intolerable?
Exactly. And
so you should be criticizing yourself, not the other, you know, political party.
Right.
If you're so awful, you have no business criticizing.
Quiet, you. No, it's them. So, well, you had a, you know, I'm kind of hopping around a little bit, but some of the trends, we ask you about like some of the emerging trends. We've covered some of those already. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about, you said, our Googleized minds will have lots and lots of dots, but no idea how to connect them any longer. Sensation will continue to overtake understanding. I think this is a nice segue.
Right, yeah, sensation over understanding. Yeah, you ask a high school student, you know, a question, and they can come up with any Googleized fact. They're full of facts. They can give you a factual answer. But ask them why, mm-hmm. and they're completely flummoxed. Mm-hmm. Ask them how. Ask them, what is your opinion about? Or how would the Civil War have been different if? Mm-hmm. And they can't. They can't, because all they know are facts. Mm-hmm. They don't know context. And so what happens is when we offload things to our devices all the time. I have what I call calculator atrophy. I learned addition and subtraction and times tables in grammar school, and I can't do it anymore. I mean, ask me 7 + 5 and I got to think a minute. It doesn't come automatically because I'm so used to the calculator. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, yeah, it's great, but you have to acknowledge that we've lost other things. It's not quite a zero sum, but you gain someplace here and you lose it somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So I think this happens in schools, is that, and in ourselves too, is that we are full of facts, but we don't have the context to know. So this is why, you know, people talk about creativity and how the sudden revelation, Poincaré stepped up on a bus, and when he put his foot on the step, all of a sudden the solution to a problem he'd been worrying about stepped into place. Kekulé had his dream about the snake eating its tail, and mm-hmm. that came up with the ring structure of the benzene molecule. Well, when that happens to people who have been thinking about a problem deeply for a long time, and they know what, of all the stuff that sweeps by them, they know what's relevant and what's not, what would be interesting and what's not. And science is this way too. You have a sense of where you should be, what tree you should be barking up.
Mm-hmm.
And this has to do with having context.
Yeah, and
so for me, when Michael Watson said, you know, when I taste things, I feel them in my face and hands, I said, oh, synesthesia. You know, I knew that word. I had found it in a book in the sub basement of the library, hadn't been checked out in ages.
Wow.
And I love words. So, oh, anesthesia, no sensation. Synesthesia, joint or coupled sensation, just like synchrony means at the same time. Mm-hmm. So I filed it away. And there this guy came up. And then shortly thereafter, a few weeks later, my hospital beeper went off. The three loud, shrill beeps. And this psychology teacher said, oh, turn that thing off, those blinding red jaggers.
Wow.
Three beeps, three blinding red jaggers. And I said, Vi, tell me more, you know? And she did. And uh-huh. So she also, I was smiling when you mentioned Nature Food Cake before, because she was talking about something and she says, you know how manganese liquid looks pink? It's exactly the same pink as my angel food cake.
Really?
So for her, she had hearing and pain and taste and color.
So, I get the.
But that comment, you know, the Blinding Big Jaggers, normally I would just, you know, turn the volume down and that would be that. But that, because I had synesthesia on the brain, her comment really hooked me.
Yeah, and it clicked together.
And then everything after that was history.
Yeah. Yeah. I talk about putting beacons out there, and then you kind of approach them again later on and then have the realization in the shower kind of thing. It all kind of clicks together with the connecting of the dots and just this inability for so many people to do it. Now, two questions. Does this seem to be mostly an American thing? And the second question, is it carrying over, or are you seeing it carrying over to university level?
Oh, it's carrying over to university, no question about it. Lord, it must be, I don't know, 5-7 years ago now, I was at GW, where I teach, and waiting for the elevator, and the doors opened and out came, I don't know, 12 students who just jostled and bumped into me because they were busy looking at their phones. They weren't looking where they were going. And I thought, even these undergraduates, they were all undergraduates, even at that age, they've already developed habits that are not going to serve them well in being able to remember, being able to comprehend, being able to synthesize. So, and of course, I can't say whether it's worldwide or not. I certainly in England it is. Again, Susan Greenfield and her proteges have written about this a lot. Australia, I've spoken with people in Australia and they say the same thing. So there's no reason why it wouldn't be a worldwide phenomenon. As long as we have this technology that's been dispersed throughout.
And we're not prepared. We haven't been able to make that shift to this 21st century mindset. Tell us about, you're working on a new book, right?
Yes, I finished it. So okay. My agent is waiting to sell it. So
okay, all right. So
it's called Digital Distractions, Your Stone Age Brain on Screens.
I can't wait to read that. When is it slated for publishing?
I don't know. I don't yet.
No idea.
It'll be hopefully this next year, and then sometime in next year.
Okay, so give us a little taste of.
Well, it just looks at this notion of distractions from the brain's point of view, and particularly from an energy consumption, because the brain makes up 2% of the body's weight, but consumes 20% of the calories that we burn each day. So it's an energy hog. I have a little TED lesson on this called What Percentage of Your Brain Do You Use?
I watched that, yeah.
You might put that link on the thing as well.
We'll do that.
So thinking actually doesn't, we burn about 25 watts, the equivalent of a dim light bulb. Most of the energy of the brain goes to maintaining the physical structure. Very little is needed for what we call thinking, behaving, acting, feeling, et cetera. That means that there's not much left over. We have a limited bandwidth of energy and of attention. So when our attention is scattered between the screens and listening to your iPods and doing, I don't know, you're watching a movie on your laptop while you're tweeting on your iPhone, we can't multitask. There's no such thing as multitasking. Multitasking simply divides everything up among a fixed amount of energy. And this fixed bandwidth of attention, there's no diet, exercise, Sudoku puzzles, whatever, supplements are going to change that. The only thing you can change is how you focus it and apportion it. And so I'm looking at this in terms of, you know, explaining what's going on in the brain, why things in the corner of our eyes, particularly in the upper quadrants, why they snag our attention involuntarily, and why sounds like the whoosh of a push notification, why that snags our attention. And all these things are just eating away at the reserves that we have. And so Zoom fatigue is a good example. I wrote a column about Zoom fatigue. you think, well, we're just looking at pictures here, but it's the video lag and having to look at several people at once, and it's an unusual situation. So like after 3 or 4 hours with students, I'm wiped out. And people say this, who work from home, to say the same thing. You know, they have 4 or 5 Zoom meetings a day, and they're bleary eyed. Their eyes are all strained. They have headaches. You got a neck pain, and you're just tired. Mm-hmm. You know, and what you should do is get up and walk and take a break. Mm-hmm. But most people don't. They just push through.
Yeah,
we're all guilty of that. I'm guilty of that. Of
not absolutely. Stopping. Yeah. Well, would you like to, are there some points you'd like to share with us? Is there something that's been on your mind that you would like to get out there, whether it's with the state of our country, with the state of, we've covered a lot here and I really appreciate it. The circadian rhythms, synesthesia, what are some deep thoughts you have to share with us?
Well, going back to circadian rhythms, I would say, go to bed. Getting sleep. We are a sleep deprived. We are wired and tired country. And we are chronically sleep deprived. It doesn't take much to relieve what's called the sleep pressure. Think of it as a hydrodynamic pressure of water that builds up, which, you know, we have to sleep. And people are sleeping, you know, 5-6 hours a night, and that's not enough. I mean, you can brag and say how macho you are by being able to do that, but the body really does need sleep to recover. It cleans out all these wastes in the brain. Mm-hmm. And for students or people who have, you know, let's say you have to give a presentation in the morning, or you've got to have a student be in school and take a test, it's much better to go to bed at a decent hour, you know, 9:30, 10 o'clock, and set an alarm to wake you up at 5:30 or 6:30 or whatever it is. Because when you front load your sleep that way, you're getting more of the stage 1, 2, 3, 4 REM cycles. Okay. Those all occur earlier in the night, and they get longer and longer as the night progresses. Mm-hmm. So if you're staying up till midnight or 1 o'clock and then get up at 6:30, you're really depriving yourself of the most restful and the deepest sleep, mm-hmm. as well as significant periods of REM sleep, the dreaming sleep. So I thought that would make a big difference. So, and as long as you're doing that, you might as well just try to turn your phone off and your iPads off as much as possible. Mm-hmm. Read a book, forget the TV. Netflix will always be there. I know. I mean, The Queen's Gambit, there was a wonderful, I enjoy all these shows, but at some point you have to say enough. There's always tomorrow.
Yeah. I think it's, I've actually taken that advice recently and it's helped a lot. And one of the things I'm going to ask for Christmas is a good old wind up alarm clock instead of the phone, you know, because I think we tend to keep the phone on because.
Well, it's okay to use your phone if it's on Do Not Disturb at night, mm-hmm. But just put it across the room so that when it goes off, then you have to get up out of bed and turn it off. And as long as you're up, well, you know, I might as well stay awake. I'm up now.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and for people who are dieting, want to lose a few pounds, go to bed. Studies show that people who get 7 or more hours of sleep at night have less trouble with weight gain than others. And of course, if you're asleep, you can't eat.
Yeah.
One thing that happened is that the brain's clock is divided into 90-minute cycles. We have 15 of these cycles throughout the day. And their sleeping cycles are followed by grooming cycles, taking a shower in the morning, followed by eating, that work, that socializing, sexual activity. And so we have 3 eating cycles that appear during the normal course of the day. And if you stay awake, then a 4th eating cycle emerges late at night. And this is where the late night munchies come. So if you're watching TV till 11:30 or midnight, it's not surprising that your eating cycle is going to pop out and you're going to say, I need a little something here. Where's my cookies, cheese, nuts, something.
there's a refrigerator calling my name.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we're about to wind up here. This has been a wonderful chat. And I just wanted to know, because of COVID, you know, and things being canceled, are you doing any online conferences or anything coming up that we can tune into?
Yeah, I've got one coming up in Melbourne. There's the main library there has this lecture series. And so we're going to be doing it via, I'm going to be doing a PowerPoint thing via Zoom, I suppose, Zoom or WebEx. Mm-hmm. That's in January.
Okay.
And then the Chicago Humanities Festivals got canceled. I don't know when that's being done, but it'll be done sometime, you know, January, February, something like that.
And do you have a newsletter on your website?
I do. If you go to my website and send me your email, I will add you onto my low frequency newsletter. I call it that because I don't want to bother people too often. So it's 3 or 4 times a year. And it's a list of links of where you can go read articles or see interviews or whatever.
And what's coming up. And
what's coming up.
Great.
Yeah. I would like to be able to get back on a plane again. The last time I flew was to Moscow last October.
Wow.
Not the past one, but the one before. So it's like, oh my God.
Dang. Yeah. Well, let's see if we get back to that point. That would be wonderful. I hear you on that. Well, really appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, my pleasure.
Again, I can't wait to read your new book. Everybody should go to your website. It's just rich with talks you've given, articles, information about your book.
Including Liberace.
Exactly. I love that article.
The Night I Danced with Liberace.
That's a great, and it's on the LA Review of Books, right?
It's linked at my website. Yeah.
It's wonderful. And thank you
and
so much.
I found
much.
The TED Talk link too.
So. Okay,
the TED Talk links are there as well. So,
yeah.
All right. So now after we unplug, we're all going to get up and at least walk around the room, if not go outside for 5 minutes.
I love that.
Promise?
Right on.
Okay.
Yes. We're going to do that.
We're going to do it.
Right. Thank you so much, Richard.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You may follow Richard Cytoic at cytoic.net. You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.